Welcome back to This Green Earth. I'm Nell Larson.
And I'm Chris Cherniak.
And joining us for the first part of the show today is Professor John Bailey. He's in the Department of Forest Engineering Resources and Management at Oregon State University. Professor Bailey, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me. I'm getting the NPR feed over top, so I can just barely hear you.
Oh, okay.
All right. Let's see if we can fix that.
How about that? Did that make a difference?
Ah, yes. Very good.
Perfect.
First
Great.
Time that's ever happened, Professor.
It's always exciting on live radio.
Rest is easy. Yes.
Live radio.
Yes.
Well, now that we've got that straightened out, like the rest of the West, I think we here in Park City have been, you know, living in the smoke for the past few weeks. And so let's start by talking about this current wildfire season and what's happening out there. How does this season compare to past years?
Well, yeah, the statistics, of course, are still coming in, and we have a ways to go. But
sure.
It's certainly consistent with the pattern that we've had over the recent years. And the deepening drought and, you know, continued, you know, level of fuel on the landscape and all, just, you know, we better get used to these kinds of patterns.
And what are the elements, the components of these patterns or trends, let's say, that have been occurring over the last 5 or 10 years?
Yeah, well, so, you know, we kind of go back to it. It varies from area to area, but, you know, we kind of just go back to the basics of what regulates fire behavior, wildfire behavior, but also prescribed burning behavior. And that's the interaction of topography, which, of course, hasn't changed too much, plus the weather. And the weather is, you know, it's shown pretty clearly that it's getting hotter and drier with just the climate change kind of cycle that we're in now. And then the third side of the fire behavior triangle is fuels. And, you know, fuels have generally been accumulating on the landscape. They accumulate every year. The forest is growing out there. The shrublands, the grasslands are growing each and every year. So if we have this trajectory where topography stays about the same, fuels are accumulating each year, and then the actual fire season is getting hotter and drier, you know, that's just a pathway where, you know, statistically you're going to see an increase in fire activity. And what really gets us is that with the lengthening of the fire season and the stretching of our resources, we just have more days where the probabilities catch up with us, that we get an ignition that can't be suppressed immediately. And so it becomes a large fire on a hot, dry, windy day, burning into those fuels, and fuels that are more connected than they've ever been. And so they become very large fires that then burn for weeks, months at a time.
Well, let's talk a little bit more about that fuel piece. When you say fuel, you're referring to the trees, the brush, everything there in the forest?
Yes, exactly, the hillsides. And that's something when I talk to groups, I talk about is when we look up at the mountains, you know, people see different things depending on, you know, what you're interested in. And some people see, you know, timber, some see scenery, some see spiritual value, some see watersheds, some see wildlife habitat. When I look up at the mountains, I see fuel. And it's all of those things, and it's all those things at once. And so we just have to remember as land managers and as a society that it is fuel and it's going to burn. We just out west, we don't have that much decomposition, you know, just given the moisture levels of those fuels. So it's growing every year, decomposes very slowly, and so for thousands of years, tens of thousands of years, fire has been a big part of the ecology of these systems and a big part of the mechanism by which, you know, fuels are removed from the landscape. And our ancestors for 10,000 years managed those fuels and the fuel complexes and the ecosystem to get the benefits that they wanted. And one of those benefits was, you know, keeping the severe fire in check.
But the climate change, our warming environment, in addition to our drying environment, our drought-like conditions that we're experiencing out west, are also leading to, at least here in the Uintas, bark beetle outbreaks, which is killing more pines and firs, which then creates a greater intensity to the fuel stockpile, let's say.
Yes, you know, it is a complicated world out
right
there, and so there is a time and space thing. You know, if the bark beetles come in and kill the trees, let's say 5 to 10 years ago, the immediate fire risk actually, you know, goes down a little bit because a lot of the fine fuels that were available to react during the combustion period when a flaming front is coming through, a lot of that falls to the ground and becomes a compact kind of smoldering layer. But if we catch it, if the fire comes through at a time when those red needles are still up on the trees,
right,
then the conditions are right. Just as if you took a dead branch versus a live branch and threw it on your campfire, you kind of get a different reaction chemistry, a different reaction physics going. So the beetle kill far in advance of fire changes actually dampens the wildfire behavior, but the intensity with which it burns changes because now you have that long-term smoldering combustion and you have large logs and standing snags and those kinds of things. So, you know, it burns the resident time of the heat on the landscape, burns longer. And so, you know, that's the difference between the intensity of the fire as it burns through versus the severity, the impact that it has on the hillside when it does burn.
So tell us what a historic fire regime might have looked like in comparison to the fires that we've been seeing for the past decade or two.
Well, through most of the forest types and ecosystems of the West, if not all of them, fire was just a common element in the system. And on one extreme would be the grasslands or the ponderosa pine ecosystems, which really were scattered trees and clumps of trees in a grassland and with scattered small shrubs and that kind of stuff. Those systems burned grasslands every year or two, the ponderosa pine every 3, 5, 7, 9 years, depending where you are. Some of that natural ignition, you know, some of that our ancestors, you know, purposely igniting or spreading the fires. The grass was very uniform. It, you know, it carried fire well, but it didn't burn particularly hot. You know, it was a low intensity but frequent burning regime. And then, as you would move up into some of the other forest types, you know, some of those times it would go out. The fuel just wouldn't be available. You know, it would be more moist or more discontinuous, you know, not as much of the grass in the understory, for example, or that kind of thing. And so the frequency would change to only every 10, 15, 25, 30 years or something like that. And therefore, when it did burn, it would burn a little bit hotter. And so the arrangement wouldn't be a uniform low-intensity fire. It would become a more spotty, low and mixed severity fire that would create little openings in those stands in the drier mixed conifer types. And as you move up into the higher elevations and the more moist forest, those patch sizes just become larger and the frequency becomes less frequent.
So when did our current, you know, extreme suppression of fire start? When did this kind of like, you know, it sounds like our predecessors were managing for fire and they used fire to their advantage. When did we kind of flip-flop to like a fear of fire and suppression?
It was, you know, a lot of our European settlement of the West. And some of it was adopting the native practices. You know, I read some accounts of this. You know, I'm not an anthropologist, but as a forester, reading some of those accounts is, you know, they recognized that the Native Americans were using a lot of fire. But we were doing roads and railroads and towns and things that were, you know, burning up. And so it pretty quickly made the, you know, we translated into that. You know, actually fire was more destructive than it was creative. And also our grazing practices interrupted that fuel availability for really frequent low-intensity surface fire to burn through those areas. Then following, you know, with the development of trucks and then aviation, World War I, World War II, we kept getting more effective. The development of the Forest Service, fire suppression was a big part of that culture and was, still is. And so you know, we spent a lot of time and became very effective at putting fire out and during the Smokey Bear era of, you know, the 50s, 60s, 70s. That was a very calm climatic period as well, so fire suppression was very effective. Fuels really accumulated. And it was in the 80s, the 90s, the 2000s that we really started seeing this trend that we're on now of very large fires and large expanses of high intensity fire, and we're starting to pay back the fire debt and the smoke debt. You know, that's what's up in the air right now is smoke that was stored, you know, maybe even 100 years ago.
If you are just joining us, we're speaking with Professor John Bailey. He's works in the Department of Forest Engineering Resources and Management at Oregon State University. And I have to ask, you know, when you talk about smoke being stored, tell us what you mean.
So, you know, through photosynthesis and biomass accumulation and slow decomposition rates, you know, some of the carbon being released into the atmosphere now with the fires in Utah was carbon that was sequestered a long time ago. And we've sequestered a level of carbon above what, you know, we think is a carrying capacity for these drier forest systems. And so that's a debt we pay back now because that smoke wasn't in the air 70 years ago.
We have a gentleman who comes on here periodically from the National Weather Service, and one of his jobs is to go out once fires have swept through areas and kind of evaluate the ground for its potential to host extreme runoff and the flash flooding that might occur from that. And what he's seeing is that fires in this area, at least in Utah that he visits, are burning with greater intensity in such that it cooks the ground in a way that makes the soil impermeable and then increases stormwater runoff, et cetera. Are you seeing similar evidence of that in your work?
Yes. You know, that issue of hydrophobicity,
the
surface of the soil, you know, being less likely to uptake water. In Oregon, our rainfall patterns are typically a little more gentle, and it's not as big of an issue. The rain comes down, smaller droplets, you know, lower impact, re-wets these areas because that is literally a chemical coating onto the soil particles. So in the more interior part of the country, including Utah, yes, that's a big issue. And post-fire hydrology, watershed, mass wastage, you know, kind of events are a very serious issue. And then as you get, that's part of this patch size dynamic, as you get into these large expanses where there's not a lot of living vegetation that is left behind to either intercept the rainfall droplets coming down, to shelter the ground, to put fresh litter back on the ground, to hold the soil in place. When we get these large expanses of very little surviving vegetation, that has very serious implications for the energy that the surface water can build up, you know, as it is eroding these hillsides. And that's what we're seeing.
Go ahead, Chris.
Well, thank you, Dale. Are you also seeing fire seasons extending in terms of, you know, when they start and when they end, per se? And I know that varies depending on where you are in the West writ large. But are fire seasons averaging greater lengths of time?
Yes, and your listeners can go to the National Interagency Fire Center. It's out of Boise, but you know, they have a great website for, you know, looking at this kind of historical data of when the fire season starts. It's starting earlier. It's going longer. The temperature records and, you know, all of that kind of thing would be available for anyone that wanted to probe it for their specific area. The Pacific Northwest now, we're basically saying our fire season is 60 days longer. I don't know what it is for Utah. My colleagues in California, you know, they talk now about their fire year. You know, it's basically 365 days for them.
Wow. So looking ahead, what, you know, how do we rein this back in, or how do we manage to get these, you know, smaller, healthier, easier to manage fires? Is there a way to do that?
Yeah, I basically talk about two approaches. One is to remember that, you know, in addition to all these other things, the hillsides are fuels, and we should remember that with everything that we normally do out there. And then we might even do some special treatments in areas like the wildland-urban interface with the fire danger in mind. and just purposely treat the fuel without damaging the watershed or the wildlife habitat, and maybe it has timber value or something. So the fuels treatment might even take precedence. But, you know, where it isn't taking precedence, we might even think about, you know, how to incorporate a fuels treatment in there. And, you know, that could be something mechanical like mowing, or, you know, I think that you know, fire has a significant ecological role. And so introducing prescribed burning into those normal land management practices and doing as much of that as possible is certainly step one, and is easy. And some of the fuel treatments can even make money rather than costing money. So that's step one, and get more prescribed burning in there. But there's going to be real limits. You know, given the accumulation of fuel and how our agencies are currently staffed and funded, there are going to be real limits to how many acres can really be done that way in advance of these wildfires, particularly as they're becoming more common and bigger and we're setting new records and all that kind of stuff. So we also have to acknowledge that wildfire is just going to do a lot of this work for us, at least over the foreseeable future, the 5 to 10 year horizon. And therefore, we can kind of partner with wildfire a little differently as well. Choose when we want to be out there burning with the wildfire. So this is kind of folding some prescribed burning thought into our actual fire suppression activities and broaden out to more of a concept of fire management. Burn these things, you know, purposefully, and help them burn when the weather conditions aren't so severe. You know, get more acreage that way when the ecological impact is at its lowest, rather than always putting it out because we can, which just kicks the can down the road to the worst weather conditions when it burns in ways that we as a society, you know, don't particularly like.
And, you know, I was just going to ask, are the fires that we're seeing today, these huge mega fires, are they doing some of the work? Would you expect now to see more of a, I don't know if normal or average is the right word, but would you expect to see sort of more of this, like, historic fire regime be restored to those places just naturally now that fuel load is gone?
Yes, if we can resist the temptation to, you know, over the next 5 or 10 years, if we get ignition back inside of a perimeter, if we can resist the temptation to just put it out and start going down the path again of unfettered fuel accumulation. So, you know, it's going to be a process of changing our thinking based on the science and changing our culture about, you know, how we put out fire, even under good conditions, how we put out the fire, which just kicks the can down the road. So, you know, 10 million acres, 20 million acres is going to be a normal number for acres burning. But the key is going to be how those 20 million acres burn, you know, that kind of thing to keep the fuels in check over time and space and the mosaic pattern that we can burn it in. And again, following the model of our ancestors.
And when you say 10 or 20 million acres, what time period are you talking about?
Oh, that's per year.
What?
Yeah.
Per
yeah.
year?
Because the West is a big place. And if it's going to, you know, if we're going to burn across it on a regular interval, you know, on a 10-year rotation, you just do the math. Just divide by 10. And that's how many acres need to burn on average each year to keep the fuels from accumulating unfettered.
The hope is just that these are smaller patches, they're less intense, and so they have a different impact, both, I would guess, on smoke and the impact on people around them, but also on safety, probably, of communities and those types of things, right?
Exactly. We choose when and where. That gives us a little bit of choice over wind directions and smoke. We can warn sensitive populations and help them, you know, with the air filters and all that kind of thing. Going to be much better than just being, you know, at the whim of the wildfires when and where they want to happen. They happen under the worst of conditions. They put some terrible smoke in the air, and particularly when they burn into communities and add some just really toxic things to the air when houses and vehicles and outbuildings and all that kind of stuff are burning, as well as the native fuels.
So I think it's so interesting that you work in a department of forest engineering resources and management. That's something that I hadn't heard of before, an entire department looking at this. So I'm just curious, this is changing gears a little bit, but what kinds of research are you and your colleagues doing to look at fire in the West?
So some of it is the pre-wildfire kind of fuels treatments and how do we do them, you know, stand by stand, 40 acres at a time.
Okay.
But then also how we might piece those together on a hillside to interrupt landscape-level fire flow. And then we have to go into the modeling world, and I have a number of colleagues that that work on that, that look at, you know, large landscapes and using geographic information systems and very sophisticated fire behavior models and that kind of stuff to look at over time how we can turn this corner and how much of the land, how many millions of acres need to burn, and those kinds of things to start getting the fire effects that we want. I and some of my colleagues work on the post-fire environment and what we can do in terms of immediate rehabilitation and slope stabilization kinds of things, and long-term restoration, whether or not we need to replant, whether or not we should salvage, what can we do with roads and culverts post-fire and all those kinds of things to protect our watersheds. So that's a big part of it as well, the post-fire work.
Yeah, and speaking of that, what is the typical length of time that, say, a burned area begins to, quote-unquote, recover and create a more stabilized setting?
Well, the recovery begins immediately. You know, ecologically, there are things that start moving in while the trees are still warm and you know, start that process, and seeds start blowing in and those kinds of things. So we look at that and think about how can we help that system recover, and if this area burned more severely than historically and prehistorically we would expect, should we plant some ponderosa pine trees, you know, back in these areas in a scattered way, you know, not in an industrial way, but
right.
You know, scattered, get some living trees back on the hillside faster than they're going to happen naturally. Certainly shrub development is in the 5 to 10 year, any resprouting shrub communities start coming back. Trees might naturally establish under that in the 2, 3, 4 decade kind of time frame before they start poking up through the shrub communities. And then it's a forest again in 100 or 200 years if you just wait for natural recovery. A landowner that isn't willing to wait, you know, there are things we can do to get it back into a forest, you know, more quickly than that.
Well, if I heard you right, you said 100 to 200 years? There are a lot of people who can't wait that long.
Yeah, if it was our 401k, we wouldn't be willing to wait 100 or 200 years.
That's the problem, a little problem we have with nature.
Yeah.
It takes its time.
A
sometimes.
Different timeline.
It's on a different timeline. I got a question for you, and this might be for another department at OSU, but what role should our planning and development be engaged in forest management or resources, meaning should we really think a little longer and harder about wanting to live in the woods in that
mm-hmm.
sense?
Or what are going to be the consequences
yes.
of that wonderful side of being able to live in the woods or right up against the woods and large wild areas? You know, it's going to be just like if you live up against the edge of a floodplain or up against the edge of anything, the coastline
right.
or something like that. You're going to be assuming some wonderful benefits of that, but you're going to be assuming some risk as well. Fortunately, with wildfire, you know, unlike sea level rise or, you know, unprecedented flooding or something like that, with wildfire and being in the wildland urban interface and all, you know, you can manage the fuels in your yard. You can manage, you know, how resistant your house, you know, is going to be. You can keep your gutters clean. You cannot stack your firewood right up against your house. All those weeds under your deck, you can, as you go into the fire season, you know, just pull those out. There are all kind of things you can do to FireWise, and so listeners can go to the FireWise.org website and look at the things you can do on your own property, what you can do as a neighborhood, getting together to make your neighborhood, you know, much more safely. And there are all kind of programs with the state and the federal government to thin the forest that's adjacent to your backyard and partner with them to minimize that risk as much as you can. Most of the houses don't burn as a wall of flame, you know, ripping up, you know, through the hillside. It's all the embers, so that the hillside is on fire, and crowning out, and it's spectacular, but there are a lot of embers in the air, and they fall on the houses and in people's yards and in their mulch and all that kind of stuff. So if you're prepared for that ember rain and you don't have the wall of flame that comes right to the edge of your house, then your house stands a chance of surviving.
I just had a listener text me with a question about fire retardant. I saw a 747 dispersing fire retardant in Southern California. I didn't think there was 747s flying around full of fire retardant. But they want to know if my home is covered in this reddish, in this color, in this case, reddish fire retardant, what kind of impact does that have on my home?
It could, if your home is the spot that is being protected by that retardant drop, it's probably to the benefit, because that, you know, it's kind of a slurry, it's a wet slurry, snot, that is sticking to. So if you have pine needles in your gutter that otherwise would burn, they now have a slimy covering on them, and as that ember rain comes in and accumulates in your gutter, it's going to be less likely that things catch on fire. Then the deleterious effect, there might be a little bit of staining if your house is white or that kind of thing, but it's basically a fertilizer, so there's not going to be any long-term damage. Overall, there's going to be the benefit that
right.
your house is protected. The problem is when you have a 500,000-acre fire, that's got thousands of miles of perimeter that you just can't put retardant on thousands of miles,
right?
Even with 747s, and so there's some real limits to what we can do with our aviation resources. It really is a spot protection kind of thing.
All right, we got to wrap up. You mentioned a couple of websites, firewise.org. Is that correct?
Yes.
And then the National Interagency Fire Center.
Yes.
Okay. Yes. Is that also? I think that's NIFC.org.
Gov, I guess.
.gov is a government. Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
I'm sure folks could Google it up, no problem.
National Interagency Fire Center has some interesting charts and diagrams on there talking about wildfires out west throughout the country. John Bailey is a professor in the Department of Forest Engineering, Resources, and Management at Oregon State University in Corvallis, Oregon.
Go Beavs.
You bet. And thank you so much for taking the time to chat with us about this important and ongoing issue here out west, John.
Thank you.